My name is Dan Brown. I'm here today with another A Lens a Day, Conversations about Information Architecture. And today I get to talk to the proficient Cassini Nazir. Cassini, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
So I've been starting these conversations talking about process because I'm really, I don't know that there's like a formal IA process or one that's been sort of documented. And so getting these little insights into how different people do IA has been really illuminating for me and hopefully others. So I guess why don't I ask you this question? When you talk about or think about the IA process, what in your mind is the ideal or the preferred starting point? You've got a new project in front of you. You're helping people get their arms around a design problem, an IA problem. Where do you start that process?
You know, the Stanford D School says start with empathy. But I think it's more important to start with curiosity. And so it's really, really important. I know this is something you've talked about, is to begin with questions. And I increasingly keep a catalog of what questions do I have about this? What questions need answering? What questions are like tangential to this that are somehow or another you find that they're related? But that critical component of what don't we know that could help us? What don't we know that hopefully we can find out more about? That I think is the foundation for not just IAs, but a lot of different fields as well. And I think it's something that, you know, when the Stanford School talks about empathy, right, it's not a discrete step. It's something that carries forward throughout. I think curiosity is something very much like that, that has to be sustained throughout the project. And so finding questions that are provocative, that are stimulating, that you want to have answered are my process for how I get started.
I love that. I mean, I'm very similar in that I start every project. In fact, as a consultant, even in the sales process, I insert questions into our proposal saying our efforts are meant to answer these questions. Otherwise, why are any of us here, right? If we know these answers, then what's the point of this project? So I love the idea of starting with questions. As you think about the kinds of questions that you ask, is the intent to, and this is gonna sound weird, to get answers to them? Or is the intent to continue to provoke that curiosity, to continue to provoke deeper inspection or research or imagination or exploration around those questions? Because sometimes I feel like we ask questions that maybe don't have a definitive answer. So how do you think about the kinds of questions that you want to ask?
That's great. Thank you for that setup too. That's a juicy question that you've got there. I think it's a both and. We certainly want answers. We have to, there's a part of us that doesn't feel fulfilled unless we get some form of answer. Whether it's the definitive answer or it's one of many answers really is contingent on the additional questions that we ask. So, right, that sustained inquiry that you're talking about where you are pursuing this question regardless if the first answer that you received is really important. I think Frank Gehry does this. You know, I know from watching documentaries about Gehry's process, he'll crinkle paper until he finds like a pleasing shape. I know he's very, people either love him or they hate him, but he crinkles paper in some of his processes until he finds a shape that's pleasing to him, that works, that fits sort of the criteria. And then he'll find out, is it actually possible to obey the laws of gravity and physics and make a building that forms this way? He says that then he casts that aside and says, now we know it's possible, let's find the best way to do it. Not every process has the sort of timescale to be able to do that, right? It's questions in a way the ability to answer questions or answer the question, what else, is really in some ways a luxury. Many of us are working in design processes that require an immediate answer. And oftentimes, if we build in reflection, the reflective answer is oftentimes a lot more holistic, a lot more exhaustive. It's more valuable. I used to have a boss who would always get upset with me because I wasn't like my colleague who would give an immediate response. And I remember having a conversation with her that essentially I told her, look, I want to be comfortable that whenever you share my answer, you share it with other people and you don't look like, you know, you don't look like an idiot. You don't get it wrong. So I want to have some level of confidence with this. Our relationship transformed after that conversation. But that notion of the ability to ask additional questions is, in some ways, it's a luxury. You know, not everybody has the ability to do that. And I do want to recognize that.
Yeah, I like your story about your former boss, because I do feel like as a consultant, what I've taught myself, or what I've, how do I put this, learned through much trial and error, is that every answer comes with a qualification, right? And maybe at the bare minimum, that qualification is based on our current understanding. And that if we truly want to embrace curiosity, we always have to acknowledge that we have differing degrees of confidence about our answer. And that the more we inquire, the more we pursue that curiosity, the more fine-tuned or different the answers become, not to mention uncovering other kinds of questions. You acknowledge that sometimes this process is very deliberate. And I do feel like that's a huge part of IA, is sort of looking at the rest of design and saying, well, we're going to take it slow over here because we got much bigger, more complex, or not more complex, but more abstract, let's say, challenges in front of us. I guess, do you have any thoughts on how to balance the kind of more deliberate thinking that an IA needs to do with the more immediate responses that today's business environment demands? And by the way, if you can solve this problem, you will satisfy the needs of millions of people, I am sure. So I don't expect you to have a like very clear answer, but I'm curious, what are your thoughts on that?
This is a delicious question. And I certainly don't have it. It's not a simple answer, but my thoughts on that are actually in the word curiosity. So our English word curiosity comes from a Latin word cura, C-U-R-A. You may be in a job that's a sinecure, right? Without a care. And the word cura means to care. So having curiosity requires some level of care. Why is, you know, asking these questions, asking why things are so, indicates a level of care, which again, I think encompasses this notion of empathy. And the idea of care, I think, is really, really critical. We care about the quality of work that we do. We care about the craftsmanship that's in that work. We care about the people for whom we build. We care about the way that might change over time. And that caring, I think, is something that can also propel us towards some of these broader components. You know, how each individual instantiates that in their own life is going to differ. But I really think that curiosity component, you know, if you unpack the layers of that word, it's not just this sort of willy-nilly, I'm interested in this, now I'm interested in that, now I'm interested in this. It's undergirded by this level of care or the things around you. Or at least that's my feelings towards
it. Love it. So why don't we switch and talk about the lens that we zeroed in on for you. What lens did you pick, and what about that resonated with you?
So the lens is distraction. And, you know, in the world that we live in, distractions are, we tend to avoid them. And we tend to navigate through our lives in ways that will sometimes, some of us, I should say, not everybody, but we'll sometimes avoid distractions, or we design systems that allow the users to avoid distractions, right? I have my phone here and it's buzzing every so often. I don't know if the audio is picking it up, right? But it's another form of distraction here. And I think the question that you ask on the lens, how might displaying structure distract users from the objectives, is a really good question to ask. But are there maybe a corollary to that, or an opposite to that, is are there distractions that might actually be valuable for the users? I'm thinking of things like your watch. I don't have one on me, but the Apple Watch that, you know, reminds you, hey, you got to stand up, or hey, you need to take a walk. There are times where distractions can actually be really, really valuable. All of this is kind of in the umbrella we were talking about earlier, under the umbrella of wayfinding. And the idea is that I'm looking for something specific, and things that get in the way may be considered a distraction. But if we're going to, let's say, a grocery store, we've got a grocery list. The notion of wayfinding is really, really important. But there's also an idea of spontaneity that's important. Oh, I didn't have that item that's on my list, but look, it's on sale, or that would be a great birthday gift for so-and-so, or what a wonderful treat for myself. You know, these ideas of distractions, perhaps, are really, really important. And, you know, I expand the concept of wayfinding to include Per Mollerup's notion, which is way showing. We as designers or information architects, we show the way. The user finds the way. And if they can find their way, they can also lose their way. And way losing is not always a bad thing, because that idea of distraction is may actually be a reason why we come or learn new things. And so it's, if we're trying to create efficiency in a system, distraction must be lowered, but that's not always the case.
I really like the physical metaphor of a grocery store. And one can easily imagine the kind of wayfinding mechanisms that they put in a grocery store. And what's cool about them is that they're not in the way. So like when I'm in a grocery store that I'm familiar with, I never need to look up at those signs because I've been through those aisles hundreds of times, right? But when I'm in a new grocery store that I've never been in before, even though I've got the general, let's call it genre of grocery store, right? And I have a good understanding of generally how grocery stores are laid out, looking for specifics, I can look up at those signs as needed. Where the metaphor breaks down, I think, for the web or for digital products is that the pixels are limited on our screens. So either we're showing content, we're showing the grocery store shelves, or we're showing the signs on how to get to those shelves. And that's, I think, where this lens came from, is my sort of constantly be confronted with, do I show the stuff or do I show how to get to the stuff? How do you reconcile those two things? Now that if we move beyond the physical metaphor, is there value in making that distinction? Are there moments where having the map or the categories or the menu or whatever it is useful, even though it's taking pixels away from the reasons the users are there?
And I think the notion of sort of the physical space applied to the digital is an important consideration, right? That not everything follows, but then the digital also affords us things that the physical didn't. You know, I can transport magically to a different section, which would take me time to get from one end of the store to the other. But it really depends on what is the outcome that we'd like to have here. I think the idea of distractions, when users find their way, when we've given them enough breadcrumbs to follow the fairy tale analogy, not breadcrumbs on a website, but the idea that you're finding your way through this by following your nose. I guess there's a priority shift in either a digital space or even an oral space, right? Because more and more of our interfaces are becoming oral, where we're hearing them or interacting with them. And we have to find ways to make sure that those work. I think the things that distract users in digital spaces, we certainly want to avoid things that have no bearing on the product that's being offered, right? A specific product detail page might have, you know, suggestions alongside it, might have other things that go along with our previous search history and the like, right? So I think that the idea of the complementary or substitutionary good may go there. But if we're going on an information journey, and we're looking for information about maybe about either the products or background information, sometimes those distractions are really, really critical, right? So selling physical products or intangible services is valuable, but those distractions can also be valuable. I'll give you an example. Let's say that we are not buying a physical product, but we're taking a trip to Hawaii. Dan has offered to take me to Oahu. Thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate that. All expenses paid. The idea of distractions there is really, really critical to me exploring what's possible. Whether or not we would use the term distraction is up for debate. It may be a semantic term, but I may not have realized, I actually need to check out this beach, or explore these restaurants, or this place exists that I'd like to go to. Maybe a little bit more closer to home, my wife and I had the opportunity to go to New Zealand 2 years ago. We had plans. I was there for a conference, there with some friends as well. We the only plan that we had was we were going to go from one end of North Island to the other. And that was basically it. Everything else was discovery along the way. And it was a beautiful experience. In planning a vacation, the idea of distraction or the idea of the unintended thing, the surprise, the spontaneity is really, really important. Because sometimes it rounds out that the expectations of the experience.
That was great. I appreciate the insights there. So one of the things, I know you're a teacher, right, of information architecture and user experience. And I've been thinking a lot about how to help newer designers get their arms around information architecture. I was fortunate enough to be in this business at the beginning where I felt like I had the space to really kind of learn on the job what IA is and what role it plays in user experience as a whole. But I'm not confident that newer designers are afforded those same opportunities. So I feel responsible to help people understand those challenges and the techniques that we can use. So the question that I'm aiming for is, if you were to offer a student or a newer designer advice on how to apply this lens, what advice might you give them? How might you coach them in thinking about distraction?
That is a great, great question. And I think what you're describing is the notion that leaders build future leaders. As an educator, that's really important to me too. Help a new generation of folks to come to an understanding of information architecture, user experience, and design. But with regard to distraction, I didn't get my start in user experience. I actually started out in a very circuitous route. My undergrad, I got into art school, didn't end up going, got into RISD. Didn't end up going for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was tuition, the cost of tuition. Ended up studying English and economics. Along the way, I convinced one of my faculty members to offer a Greek literature class, study Greek language, started a degree in classics down at UT Austin, ended up leaving because, you know, there is zero job opportunities for that. For me, that sort of circuitous route is an important thing because you end up learning a ton from experiences that you don't know on the front end, but only if you have the component of reflection will you realize on the back end. Like there's an increasing mindset for efficiency. I need to get through things quickly. I need to get from A to B as quickly as I can. And I think the information's out there. The, you know, you don't necessarily need to go to university to understand some of these principles because the books in many cases are freely available. There's courses that are freely available or cheaply available, right? So the value for me of what I do and what I teach are the series of experiences that we can learn and the people that you learn with. Who you learn with is often just as valuable as what you learn. And the notion that I'm just going to get there as quickly as possible is oftentimes when you're dealing with humans, designing things for humans is oftentimes not the best route. You've got to have some level of exploration to understand, you know, what does understanding backroom logistics have to do with, you know, selling products? I remember what the first and only job I ever got fired from was a retail shop. Did a poor job, but I learned a ton about backroom, you know, back of house operations that, you know, lend themselves to service design, lend themselves to an understanding of business. And I think those series of experiences are important. The notion of distraction oftentimes implies that, oh, that experience was wasted. The real critical thing is to the designer who's able to connect those seemingly disparate series of experiences into something greater and something more meaningful. So for me, a lot of it goes back to those early experiences I had that are sort of foundational in, right, English, economics, Greek literature, et cetera, that just sort of inform the way that I view the world now and help me to ask questions around me.
I think that is hugely important. I went to college in the early 90s, so before the internet was the commercial and, you know, life-changing thing it is today. So there was no, and I did know that I wanted to be a designer, but I went to a liberal arts college and I feel today more grateful, every day I feel more grateful for that education because the nuts and bolts of design, as you say, are, you know, are skills, technical skills that are relatively easy to pick up. But the complexity of the projects that we are working on these days call for the capacity to juggle multiple perspectives, to do critical thinking, and to come up with questions, as we just come back around to the beginning, which is at the heart, I think, of a liberal arts or humanities-driven education. How do you bring that to your classrooms? What do you do to kind of bring that to the students that you get to interact with?
You know, where I'm teaching currently, it's fully project-based learning. So the notion of a classroom isn't even the right term, because when we say the word classroom, we generally think one-to-many communication. So faculty members standing up and then, you know, 30, 60, how many other students sitting in rows of chairs and listening. The first thing is flipping that on its head. Project-based learning is what interaction, information architecture, and design faculty do, right? You do a bunch of shoulder-to-shoulder work where rather than taking notes furiously, you're interacting. And you're actually coming to class ready to engage And so more is demanded of you. And oftentimes students will sort of bristle at that at the beginning. Oh, I don't like this. Why don't you just sort of spoon feed us the way that we were used to in high school or other classes and the like? But it really demands more of the students because there's active ownership in their learning. That's really, really critical. I think the other, so two other things there. Whole body thinking is not to be overlooked, right? These are IA lenses that we're discussing. You know, I did want to throw out the idea that what if it was IA hearing, right? Our brain take so much of our brain is actually taken up by our visual affordances, but you know, our hearing is really, really important. When you work in VR, you cue people by the sounds, right? You get somebody to look left by the sound or look right by the sound that's coming in those directions. So the idea that students not just think with their brains, but with their bodies. So in my classrooms, students will stand up, will do silly activities, right? How do you demonstrate balance, right? You can stand up straight, but show me asymmetrical balance as is physically possible. So students will contort themselves, right, in various different ways to demonstrate balance. And it hits the brain differently when you are using your body to do this rather than just sort of your brain and looking at it. The third thing that I'm getting students to do more and more is to keep a curiosity journal. So this is a journal that has only questions and no periods, right? So everything in this is questions only. And the idea is, just like any kind of physical activity that requires warm up, our brains kind of require that too. We've got to learn how to ask better questions. Depending on the education system, we've sometimes been focused on answers, not questions. And so the notion of the journal helps us to just get into the habit of asking questions. The more that you do it, the better that you become at it.
That was great. We will leave it there. Cassini, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it.